The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We thank them for their continued support. Today we're reading from SmithsonianMag.com. The Smoked Paprika Museum in Spain honors a family tradition. In Extremadura, entire families participate in harvesting peppers and making smoked paprika, by Jennifer Billock. When Christopher Columbus returned from his second voyage to the New World in 1496, he brought a special gift to Ferdinand and Isabella, the royals who financed his journeys. Paprika. Well, to be more accurate, he brought them capsicum peppers, the ingredient used to make paprika. He brought them from South America, and although, legend says, Ferdinand and Isabella thought them a bit too spicy, the duo handed them over to the monks at two monasteries, the monastery of Yeste and the monastery of Santa Maria de Guadalupe, who began to cultivate them in the 16th century. Families living near these monasteries in Extremadura, Spain, began to grow the peppers about the same time, drying the vegetables in smokehouses on wooden racks to create a smoky, colorful spice that took the country by storm. Spanish smoked paprika isn't the same as any old paprika. There are actually three types. Sweet paprika, or what's regularly labeled as just paprika, which can come from various locations and is often mixed with cayenne. Hungarian hot paprika, which has eight variations of spiciness and originates in Hungary. And smoked paprika, which originates in Extremadura, La Vera region in Spain. Today, smoked paprika is still made in Extremadura, a region in western Spain bordering Portugal, near the original monastery where Columbus presented it. Historically, the spice was produced by family businesses, and it's still largely this way today. Alvaro Hernandez Nieto is the fourth generation in his family to run a smoked paprika company, Pimentón La Dalia. Hernandez's great-grandfather, Valerino Hernandez Martin, founded La Dalia in 1913, naming it after the flower he presented to his future wife when he proposed. Some of La Dalia's original paprika canisters are on display in the Smoked Paprika Museum in Jerez de la Vera. The museum, which opened in 2007 in a 17th-century brick row house, honors Hernandez's family and others in the region who have been instrumental in the production of the spice. Three floors of exhibits describe the history and process of making smoked paprika, through antique production tools, recipes, and videos, to more than 11,000 people who visit annually. Valerino was a pioneer and a visionary, says Hernandez, speaking of how his great-grandfather helped promote the commercialization of Spanish smoked paprika. He began La Dalia as soon as he possibly could. It was one of the first factories in the area. He originally bought the paprika from small farmers who ground the dried peppers in water mills of the many gorges that bathe the area. Then on horseback he would carry it to every corner in the markets of the towns of the province. La Dalia is a member of the Pimentón de la Vera Co-op, a group of 17 brands and family-owned businesses creating protected designation of origin certified smoked paprika in Spain. The La Vera region of Spain, in the Cáceres province of Extremadura, is the ideal place to produce this type of paprika, thanks to its subtropical climate, salt-free water, and soil with high organic matter content. Planting begins in May and June, and the ripe red peppers are harvested in September and October. Then the smoking begins. Smoking is done in the traditional La Vera style, dehydrating the mature fruit in a smokehouse with oak firewood, Hernandez says. This process must be slow, with a duration of about 15 days to ensure maximum moisture content of 15% at the end of drying. Drying the peppers this way gives the product a light smoky flavor, an unmistakable aroma, and a color stability that doesn't deteriorate in cured sausages with the passage of time. Once dry, the stems are removed and the peppers are ground in a mill. Workers have to ensure the peppers don't get any hotter than about 120 degrees Fahrenheit during this whole process, or else the smokiness, taste, color, and scent of the paprika will be ruined. The ground powder is then quality certified according to protected designation of origin guidelines, ensuring it was made in the traditional way, packaged and shipped out for sale. The resulting product is an intense red powder with a delicate wood-smoked scent and flavor. And the paprika specific to La Vera actually has antioxidant properties. A study published in the Journal of Food found that these properties are specific to this paprika because of the drying and smoking process. The firewood smoked drying is a consequence of the rainy autumns of La Vera, because it was impossible for the peppers to dry in the sun, Hernandez says. The smoke drying system makes La Vera paprika unique around the world. It gives it an aroma and flavor so extraordinary that today's best chefs call it the red gold of Vera. Jennifer Billock is an award-winning writer, best-selling author, and editor. She is currently dreaming of an around-the-world trip with her Boston Terrier. This next story is on Doris Day, who coincidentally just died. Doris Day's biggest hit is a song she could have done without. Que Sera Sera is synonymous with the actress and singer who died on Monday at age 97. Though she was never a fan of the tune, she called it a kiddie song by Jason Daly. Hollywood icon Doris Day starred in dozens of movies and released more than 600 songs in her lifetime. But the box office star, known for her singular voice, never came around to the hit that might have been most associated with her career. Whatever will be, que sera, sera. In fact, Day, who died at age 97 on Monday, May 13, never wanted to sing the song in the first place. As it turned out, almost everyone involved with the tune was a bit reluctant to make it. Here's what happened. Doris Day was cast in Alfred Hitchcock's 1956 film, The Man Who Knew Too Much, alongside Jimmy Stewart. Hitchcock did not originally want Day in the film, but to get Stewart on board, he had to agree to also hire Day and give her a song in the film penned by the famed songwriting duo Jay Livingston and Ray Evans, the writers behind such classics as Silver Bells and Mona Lisa. Hitchcock agreed. His instructions to the songwriters were vague. "I don't know what kind of song I want," he said, "but Jimmy Stewart is a roving ambassador, and it would be nice if the song had some foreign words in the title. Also in the picture, I have set it up so that Doris sings to their little boy." With foreign inspiration on their minds, the team wrote Que Sera Sera after watching the Ava Gardner film, The Barefoot Contessa, where they noticed the inscription Che Sera Sera, or whatever will be, on the fictional family's Italian villa. Inspired by that phrase, the team changed it to Spanish, it also works in French, and wrote the composition. They had called it simply Que Sera Sera before realizing another song by that name already existed. Hitchcock declared the song perfect, but Day was not as thrilled. In 2012, she told Terry Gross at NPR's Fresh Air that she did not understand why such an upbeat, lilting song would be in a movie about a kidnapped boy. "I thought, I'm not crazy about that," she recollected. "Where are they going to put it? You know, for what? Is it when I put him in bed sometime and I sing that to him or something? I did that in another film, and I thought maybe that's what it's going to be. And I didn't think it was a good song." Martin Chilton at The Telegraph reports that Day also called it a kiddie song. But her third husband, Martin Melcher, who was also her manager, convinced her to record it. In the movie, she does sing it as a lullaby, playing Joe McKenna, one half of an American couple whose vacation turns tragic after their child Hank is taken. She and her husband, Jimmy Stewart, must follow various clues to find him, ultimately realizing he's being held at an embassy. There, Joe performs the song in hopes that Hank will hear it and recognize his parents are near. Her performance won the film the 1956 Academy Award for Best Original Song, and the song reached the number 2 slot on the Billboard charts. Day reluctantly accepted the popularity the song garnered. "So maybe it isn't a favorite song of mine, but people loved it, and kids loved it," she told Gross. "And it was perfect for the film. So, you know, I can't say that it's a favorite song of mine, and I think it's a fabulous, but boy, it sure did something. It came out, and it was loved." The song became so associated with the star that it ultimately became the theme song for The Doris Day Show, a sitcom that aired between 1968 and 1973. In her 1976 autobiography, Day revealed that she was contracted to do the sitcom by Melcher and hadn't even been aware of the arrangement before his death in 1968. She didn't want to do a television show, much less one with a song as a theme. Luckily for Day, she wasn't called upon to sing Que Sera, Sera after that. When the series ended, she retired from showbiz, moving to Carmel, California, where she dedicated herself to being an activist for animal rights and sang whatever songs she so chose. Jason Daly is a Madison, Wisconsin-based writer specializing in natural history, science, travel, and the environment. His work has appeared in Discover, Popular Science, Outside, Men's Journal, and other magazines. Up next, the history of the drive-in movie theater, the continued attraction of viewing movies under the stars, by Robin T. Reed. On June 6, 2008, the flag flying over the U.S. Capitol commemorated the 75th birthday of a distinctive slice of Americana, the drive-in movie theater. It was on that day in 1933 that Richard Hollingshead opened the first theater for the Autobound in Camden, New Jersey. People paid 25 cents per car, as well as per person, to see the British comedy Wives Beware, Under the Stars. The concept of showing movies outdoors wasn't novel. People often watched silent films on screens set up at beaches and other places, boasting an abundance of sky. However, it took an auto parts salesman such as Hollingshead to see the genius in giving a car-loving society one more activity they could do in their vehicles. He first conceived the drive-in as the answer to a problem. His mother was, how shall I say it, rather large for indoor theater seats, said Jim Kopp of the United Drive-In Theater Owners Association. So he stuck her in a car and put a 1928 projector on the hood of the car and tied two sheets to trees in his yard. Hollingshead experimented for a few years before he created a ramp system for cars to park at different heights so everyone could see the screen. He patented his concept in May 1933 and opened the gates to his theater the next month. The second drive-in, Schenkweiler's, started a year later in Orafields, Pennsylvania. A few others followed, but the concept didn't really get traction until the advent of in-car speakers in the early 1940s. By 1958, the number of drive-ins peaked at 4,063. Drive-ins started to really take off in the 50s, Kopp said. They offered family entertainment. People could sit in their cars, they could bring their babies, they could smoke. Drive-ins offered more flexibility than indoor theaters. The indoor theaters were more flexible about scheduling, however, and could show one film 5 or 6 times a day instead of only at night. So to sell as many tickets as possible, the movie studios sent their first runs to the indoor theaters. Drive-ins were left to show B-movies and eventually X-rated ones, and being naughty helped some drive-ins survive. D. Vogel, owner of the Benji's Drive-In near Baltimore, Maryland, said the price of land is the real reason many drive-ins folded. People would build on the outskirts of town, and the town would grow, he said. Combine that with the fact that so many drive-ins were mom-and-pop businesses that few descendants chose to continue running, he explained. The results were a sinking number of drive-ins throughout the country. There's not enough income in it, or else you'd see AMC and others getting drive-ins, Vogel said. It's hard-earned money. Today, some 400 drive-ins remain in the United States, a number that has not changed much in the past 5 years. Another 100 drive-ins exist outside the United States, mainly in Canada and Australia. Kopp said the concept is suddenly becoming popular in China. More than 75% of the drive-ins in this country are privately owned small businesses, according to the National Association of Theater Owners. Digital cinema will be both an opportunity and a threat for drive-in owners, said the association's director of media and research, Patrick Corcoran, in an email. An opportunity because digital will allow them to get new movies sooner than they do. They're often weeks behind the break for new films. It's a threat in that the digital transition will be expensive to manage and some may not be able to do it. Kopp, of course, bets on the drive-in survival. In 2005, he and his wife bought the Raleigh Road Outdoor Theater in Henderson, North Carolina, for $22,000 on eBay. He said they've invested about $300,000 since to clear the 7 acres of weeds and modernize the technology. Today, the theater can accommodate 265 cars and show movies in a 60-foot by 80-foot screen. The sound comes through car radios. Film Fair of the Raleigh Road and other drive-ins typically consist of G-rated films, Kopp said. Disney movies thrive, as do animated films. We've had some folks that come out on a weekly basis. It's almost like a tailgate party, Kopp says. He's seen his share of fogged-up windows, too, including a middle-aged couple too passionately involved to notice that the theater's lights were off and gates were locked. And then there are people who sneak in without paying. Last week we were patrolling the property in the golf cart, and we saw a hole in the fence, Kopp said. Some kids had been running through, so we put some chairs up and some popcorn out and left a sign that said, "At least sit down and watch the movie." We were kids once, too. The next day, the popcorn was gone. Here are a few readers' comments. Bill Mundy says, "The Twin Air Drive-In in Indianapolis holds many childhood memories from the 60s for me." Russ says, "I'm surprised the article or previous comments didn't include sneaking in via the trunk. We'd always take my friend's 66 Continental because the trunk was huge." And Emmanuel Adams says, "Help me find the cat in the thing." Not sure what that refers to. Rob Babu says, "A guy named Craven or something like that had the first drive-in movie in Comanche, Texas, back in 1921. Today, the Holiday Drive in Reno, Indiana, that opened in the 50s, continues and has expanded to 6 screens. The place is crowded most nights when it's opened. Each screen has a double feature." And Casey Whiteside writes, "Hello, Robin. My name is Casey Whiteside. I'm a graphic designer student in Northern Virginia Community College. We are creating a magazine for our final project, and I'm doing it on drive-ins. I was interested in permission to use your article on the history of drive-in theaters. Hope to hear back from you soon. Casey Whiteside." And there's no reply yet on that. Charles Martinez writes, "My parents used to take us to the auto park in Tampa, Florida. It was only 2 miles from the house. My parents would drink beer and my sister and I soda. Fritos were the special treat. It was on the Tampa Bay and the mosquitoes were fierce. They sold these coils we had to burn on the dashboard to keep them away, which would stain the windshield. When the movie got steamy, I was told to go to sleep on the floor of the Rambler, which had a hump." Yeah, that was going to happen. I miss those days. Idania writes, "I just loved the drive-ins growing up as a kid in the 70s. Wonderful times and great outdoor movie watching. Sadly, all things worthwhile never last. Hope drive-ins come back one day. Miss them. Beth says, there are two on either side of my hometown, Gasport, New York. One is in Middleport and the other in Lockport, both within 10 miles of my house. I didn't know this was weird until after I graduated high school. Jim writes, our town may be one of the few that still has a drive-in. Ceres, California. C-E-R-E. Ceres, California. And Michelle Hauser writes, there is a drive-in theater on the naval base in Rota, Spain that I used to go to as a teenager when my mom was stationed there. My friends and I had some of our best times there. I understand it's still used on weekends. Some of us are wondering whether it's the only drive-in in Europe, but I can't seem to find that information via any search engines. Does anyone know or have ideas where to find out? Thanks. Michael J. McClellan of Michigan says, I was stationed in Rota and have many memories. Friends and I saw American Graffiti at the base drive-in. Then we went to the AFRTS radio station to see our friend Pablo. We gave him that name because he liked the group Pablo Cruz. Good times in the early 70s. Eric Hegstrom writes, going to the 88th drive-in in Commerce City, Colorado is the highlight of the summer. You can't beat the double feature deal, taking the dog, the kids, and watching people set up for the movie. Getting ready for the movie is half the fun. Zip Exec says, Cloverleaf Drive-In at the bottom of the hill and next to the canal in Valley View, Ohio. Of course, there was a Big Boy restaurant across the street, which was a great after-show stop in our muscle cars. The gas was cheap. Leander Stoud, our children love the Schenkweiler Drive-In. It is a wonderful place to watch movies. Jessica Carlin says, I still love going to the Warwick Drive-In in Warwick, New York. It's great on weekends, especially when the weather is nice, to sit outside and watch a movie on the big screen. Fred Nungesser writes, I remember many a night at the drive-in at Paramus, New Jersey. I'm not sure we can get through this next story, but we'll try. Nine famous people and what they're buried with. Icons of their time, these celebrities didn't stray far from their public persona when it came to their final resting place. By Greg Daugherty. When the comedian David Brenner died earlier this year, obituaries reported that he'd asked to be buried with $100 in small bills, just in case tipping is recommended where I'm going. Brenner's not the first celebrity to challenge the conventional wisdom, you can't take it with you. Here are nine more. Leonard Bernstein, the famous conductor and composer whose works included the musicals On the Town and West Side Story, was buried with a piece of amber, a lucky penny, a baton, a copy of Alice in Wonderland, and a pocket score of Gustav Mahler's Fifth Symphony, according to the 2014 biography Leonard Bernstein, an American musician. While each item had its significance in Bernstein's life, the Mahler Symphony was probably closest to his heart. At least one account claims it was placed directly over his heart in the casket, though others say it was simply put in alongside him. Humphrey Bogart. Before the actor's cremated remains were laid to rest, they were supposedly joined in their urn by a small gold whistle bearing the inscription, If you want anything, just whistle, which he had given his widow, Lauren Bacall, years earlier. The line was a reference to their 1944 film, To Have and Have Not, loosely based on an Ernest Hemingway novel, in the first movie to pair the then 43-year-old Bogart and his 19-year-old future wife, though the quote in the inscription is often cited as a line of dialogue from the movie, what Bacall's character actually says would have required a much bigger whistle. You know, you don't have to act with me, you don't have to say anything, you don't have to do anything, not a thing, oh, maybe just whistle. You know how to whistle, don't you, Steve? You just put your lips together and blow. For whatever reason, Bogart seems to have inspired memorial misquotations. Perhaps his most famous line of movie dialogue, play it again, Sam, from 1942's Casablanca, never appears in the actual movie either. George Burns, For the vaudeville, radio, television, and movie comedian, cigars were a constant prop, and he went to his grave with three in his pocket. What brand those might have been doesn't seem to have been recorded, though Burns was known to favor El Producto Queens. He explained the very practical reason behind his preference in a 1994 interview with the magazine Cigar Aficionado. The interviewer was Arthur Marx, son of well-known cigar-chomping comedian Groucho Marx. Burns told him, "The reason I smoke a domestic cigar is because the more expensive Havana cigars are tightly packed. They go out on the stage while I'm doing my act. The El Producto stays lit. Now, if you're on stage and your cigar keeps going out, you have to keep lighting it. If you have to stop your act to keep lighting your cigar, the audience goes out." Roland Dahl, the author of the children's book Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, which marks its 50th anniversary this year, celebrated chocolate in both his art and his life. So it isn't surprising that he was reportedly buried with some, as well as a bottle of Burgundy, snooker cues, pencils, and a power saw. In his 1984 memoir, Boy, Dahl wrote that one of his happiest childhood memories involved the newly invented candy bars that the British chocolate maker Cadbury sent to his boarding school from time to time, asking Dahl and his classmates to rate them. He fantasized about working in a chocolate laboratory when he grew up and inventing a chocolate that would wow even the great Mr. Cadbury himself. That fantasy, he said, became the inspiration for Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. If Dahl didn't grow up to become a chocolate inventor, he did remain a chocolate lover. He is said to have kept a red plastic box stuffed with chocolates, which he'd offer to guests after every meal, or simply eat by himself if he was dining alone. The box is preserved at the Roland Dahl Museum Archives in the village of Great Missenden, north of London. Harry Houdini, the famous magician escape artist, was buried with his head resting on a packet of letters from his beloved mother, Cecilia Weiss. As Houdini's friend, Howard Thurston, perhaps the second most famous magician of the day, observed at the time, his love for his mother was his deepest devotion. Cecilia's death in 1913 had been a shock that her son never quite recovered from. Hoping to communicate with her in the next life, Houdini became fascinated with the then-popular fad of spiritualism. Open-minded at first, he was soon disenchanted and spent much of the remainder of his life exposing the tricks of psychics and mediums. We hope you've enjoyed today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. We thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. That's www.TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 832-5138.